You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How completely do you see the world? While many of us are grateful for clear vision, fewer have considered the pleasures and benefits of seeing depth and space. But try this if you are not behind the wheel of a car right now. Look at something in front of you with both eyes, and then close or cover one of them. Suddenly, your field of vision flattens. Everything is still there, but it appears before you on a flat plane, a bit like the perspective you would have looking at a conventional movie screen. My guest today lived with that sort of vision for 48 years after developing crossed eyes as an infant. As a neuroscientist, she was well aware of the research that found stereopsis, or 3D vision, develops during a critical period early in life, and she was not inclined to believe her brain could rewire itself to see depth. Her new book explains how that belief and her life began to change after just two therapy sessions. Susan R. Berry is professor of neurobiology at Mount Holyoke College. The book is called Fixing My Gaze, A Scientist's Journey into Seeing in Three Dimensions. Sue, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
One of the things I find really fascinating about your story is the fact that you did not realize you were stereo blind, meaning not seeing in three dimensions, until you were in college. Can you talk about that?
Yes, that's correct. Even though I had three surgeries as a child, and my latest surgery was when I was 7 years old, so I certainly remember it very well, I assumed I had perfect vision. And the reason for that is that I had 20/20 vision in both eyes. So if you tested my eyes with the standard eye chart, the one with the big letter E on top, I could read that chart as well as anyone else. Although, if you think about it, when you read that chart, you read it by looking with one eye and occluding, you know, patching the other. And so since I had 20/20 vision and I didn't wear glasses, I assumed I had perfect vision. In fact, my brother and sister were both nearsighted and wore glasses for being nearsighted, and I thought I had better vision than them.
But there were some problems that you had as a kid that nobody thought could have anything to do with your eyes.
That's true. I had a lot of trouble reading, learning to read in school. And the reason for that is this. I was cross-eyed. And even though my surgeries made my eyes look straight, I was still cross-eyed. That is, I still looked with one eye and then turned in the other. So if I were, for example, looking at your face, I might be looking at your face with my right eye and my left eye would be turned in. Or I might have been looking at your face with my left eye, and my right eye would turn in. And after my surgery, these turns were more subtle, so people didn't notice so much that my eyes crossed, but they still did.
And what was happening for you was that the brain would sort of register one eye and not pay any attention to the other when this happened.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I would. The eye that was looking, let's say at your face, that was doing the looking is what my brain paid attention to. And the eye that turned in, my brain sort of turned off that input, suppressed that input, ignored it as if it weren't there. However, I was always switching between my two eyes, pretty much every glance. So one moment I'm looking at you with the right eye and the left eye's turned in, and the next moment I'm looking at you with the left eye and the right eye's turned in.
So you never had a sense that you were not seeing out of one side or the other because it was happening so rapidly.
Exactly. I did not know I was switching eyes. But I did know when I was a little kid and I tried to read that the letters jumped around on the page. And this happened because if I looked at the letters I would be looking at the letters, let's say, with my right eye, and then with my left eye, and then with my right eye, and then with my left eye. And think about it, if you're cross-eyed, I actually saw with my right eye letters that were located to the left of the letters I saw with my left eye. And so I can remember having trouble reading in school. In fact, looking at a word like was and wondering, was the word was or was it saw? It was sometimes difficult to pinpoint the place on the page where the letter was.
And that must have been even harder when the text was small.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that happens in third grade. When you move into third grade, the print gets smaller in the school books. And I'm not the only one. Often children who have vision problems, their problems get a lot worse at that stage.
And in fact, there are some links now to behavior that looks like ADHD that may have more to do with vision than we thought before.
Absolutely. There's a common cause of vision problems called convergence insufficiency. And what that basically means is this. Convergence means turning in your eyes. if you think about it, or you could try this experiment with a friend, have them look at a pencil that you're holding upright, right in front of their nose, and then move the pencil away from their nose and back toward their nose and away from their nose and so on. And you'll see that when you move the pencil in closer and they're following the pencil in closer, they turn in their eyes. And when you move the pencil away, the eyes straighten. And that turning in is called convergence. So convergence insufficiency means that a child, when they look at something close, does not turn in the eyes enough to image what they're looking at, let's say a word on a page, to image those letters on the same place on the retina of both eyes. Instead, what the child might do is follow the letters with one eye and let the other eye drift out. So they're not converging properly, and that's why it's called convergence insufficiency. But when this happens, basically now the two eyes are not aiming at the same letter. And so the child might notice blurry vision. The child might notice double vision, seeing two letters or seeing one letter and a shadow of another. Or the child might notice that the letters seem to jump around a little. But this is a little kid, and the child doesn't even know that this is not normal. And so the child may be struggling to read, having trouble, and then becoming a behavior problem as a result, and certainly not wanting to do their homework and do more reading. And, of course, then the child may be saddled with some label, you know, some sort of learning disability or even ADHD, when in truth nobody's looked to see whether or not they have good normal binocular vision.
Yeah, you were placed in remedial classes because of these problems.
Yes, I was. So what happened to me is, again, it was right at that third grade point. At the end of second grade, I had to take a standardized achievement test. Think about those tests with the little circles that you fill in. Some people call them bubble tests. They are hard to do if you are having trouble precisely aiming your eyes on a page. And I did very poorly on a standardized achievement test. And this was in the early 1960s. And back then, and to some extent now, but much more so back then, people assumed that these tests were objective and they really were a measure of a child's intelligence. And so what happened is, when I did poorly on the test, the principal of my school said, well, these tests are an objective measure of intelligence, and he told my parents, you need to face facts, you have a dumb kid.
And your mom refused to believe it.
My mom, who is my hero in a way, she passed away about 7 years ago, and I dedicated my book to her. She did refuse to believe the principal, and what she did was this. So the principal told them I was dumb. I was put in this remedial class, and every kid in this class had a problem. And, you know, the problems ranged from being very, very disruptive to my best friend in the class had polio and walked with a limp. So it was basically any kid who was not normal by, you know, the standards of the day. So my mom went to talk to the principal, and the principal said, nope, the tests are objective. And you're certainly not objective, and even the teacher isn't objective, because the teacher's known the child for a long time, so may have a soft spot for the child and not realize that, you know, she's as dumb as these tests indicate she is. So what happened is my mother talked to a friend of hers who worked for the school department, and she actually borrowed a set of keys from this friend. And then after school one day, she went into the school, kind of broke into the school and into the principal's office and took a copy of the test. And she brought it home. And you have to understand, my mother was the sweetest, soft-spoken, most gentle person.
Not a rule breaker.
Not a rule breaker by any stretch of the imagination. Just a very calm, sweet individual, but persistent in her own quiet way. And she took the test, and she took me, and we went down to the basement of our house, and part of the basement was above ground, part was below. So she closed the drapes on the windows in the part of the basement that had windows, and She told me not to breathe a word to my brother or sister, and she gave me the test. And I did better. I don't think I scored genius level, but I scored well enough for my mother to realize that, you know, I wasn't as such a low intelligence as the principal thought I was. So she went back and argued with the principal again, but she couldn't tell him, you know, I broke into your office and stole this test. And when the principal said, no, she stays in the remedial class, that was that. I just stayed in that class for 2 years.
So you went through all these years without stereo vision, without 3D vision, and some of the other problems that you had were when you were in motion, in a car, on a bike, even walking fast.
Right.
What made it hard to see in those situations?
It was hard to see while I was moving because I had a very unstable gaze. And what that meant that I was constantly switching my gaze between my two eyes, and they were still slightly misaligned. My right eye saw, not only were they horizontally misaligned, so pointing differently in the horizontal plane, but they were vertically misaligned. So my right eye actually saw a few degrees lower than my left eye did. And so I was constantly switching my view between these two eyes. Now, if you're just standing still and you're looking at something else that is standing still, it's okay. But if you're moving, or if the thing you're trying to look at is moving, and you're switching between your two eyes, then you just have a very jittery worldview. So I had a hard time learning to ride a bicycle. I would walk the bike down hills because I grew up in a very hilly area, and I'd walk the bike down hills for the first year that I had a bike. And I really didn't want to learn to drive a car. I found that really frightening.
But I guess because you didn't know you had a problem, you did sort of compensate and find ways to calculate how far away things were in space. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, everybody has what are called monocular cues to depth, meaning monocular meaning cues you can see with just one eye. So, for example, if I look across my desk now, I see that my telephone is blocking my view of a book behind the telephone. So I know the telephone is in front of the book because it's blocking the view. Let's see, some other cues. Shading and shadow. So things look round because of shading and shadow. Because the sun is up high in the sky, if you look at a round object, the top part of it will be in light and the bottom part will be in shadow. So those are cues to sort of the roundness and shape of things. And so those were some of the cues that I could use to gauge shape and distance. Another is perspective, of course. If you look down, let's say, a long line of tire tracks, railroad tracks, they converge. You know, the tire tracks seem to narrow and come together as you look in the distance. So these gave me cues to distance and shape. But I did not have a sense of space as having volume. And I did not have a sense of how much volume there was, how much volume of space there was between one thing and another.
Susan R. Berry is my guest. She's professor of neurobiology at Mount Holyoke College. Her new book is called Fixing My Gaze, A Scientist's Journey into Seeing in Three Dimensions. We'll find out how all of this changed for Susan in just a moment. You're welcome to call 1-800-933-5372 and join the conversation, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mount Holyoke College Professor of Neurobiology Susan R. Berry. Her new book is called Fixing My Gaze, A Scientist's Journey into Seeing in Three Dimensions. So when all systems are go and things are working properly, how do most of us see in 3D?
Well, what most of us do is when you're looking at any object, you turn both eyes to look at that object. You aim both eyes at that object. So if I'm looking at my telephone right now, then I am aiming both eyes on the telephone, and the image of the phone is falling on the central part of the retina of both eyes. But other objects that are located in front of or behind the phone are falling on different parts of the retina, which is the sheet of photoreceptive cells at the back of the eye. So objects in front and behind the phone that I'm looking at are falling on different parts of the two retinas, the right and left retina. And your brain takes that information into account and assigns the location for those objects as either in front of or behind the phone.
And the way that we sort of fuse the image from the left eye and the right eye, mm-hmm. we should say, by the way, there are a bunch of really interesting sort of try-it-yourself tests in the book and in illusions and things like that. But maybe you can talk to us about the hand and the tube experiment that people, again, who are not driving, might be able to try to get a sense of this.
Okay, this is a real crowd pleaser, and it really points up a very important point. And that point is that because you turn your eyes either in when you look at something close or turn them out to look at something further away, because you turn your eyes so that the object you're looking at falls on the central place of the retina of both eyes, right smack in the back of the eye, then your brain interprets what falls on the central part of your right retina and what falls on the central part of your left retina as being in the same place in space. So in the hole-in-the-hand experiment, which I think is what you're describing,
right.
What you are going to do is actually have your two eyes looking at two different things, but those two different things are going to fall on the same place in the back of the retina, and you're going to see them in the same place. So here's what you do. Take an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. Doesn't really have to be 8.5 by 11, but, you know, a regular sheet of paper, and roll it up into a tube. And, you know, the tube should have a diameter of maybe, I don't know, 2 inches.
Like a paper towel tube.
Like a paper towel tube. Now take the tube and put it in front of one of your eyes. Let's say your right eye. So you have the tube in front of your right eye, and you're looking through the tube. And now take your free hand, which should be your left hand, because your right hand's holding the tube in front of your right eye. Take your left hand and take the palm of your hand so it's facing you. So the palm's facing you. That means your thumb would be to your left. And put that hand up against the tube. Put it up against the sort of the far end of the tube. But make sure that hand is well up against the tube. It's touching the tube.
On the side.
On the side. Mm-hmm. So put the hand on the side of the tube toward the far end of the tube, and now look through the tube, open, have both your eyes open, and what you should see is you'll see the tube and you'll see the hand, but you'll see the tube as running right through the middle of your hand, right through the palm.
It was a lot of fun to try that, and it's a great example, I think, of things. I was amazed, Sue, at how many people out there are walking around without stereopsis, without the ability to see things in three dimensions.
Well, about 5% of the population. So that's 1 in 20 people, which means at least one child in the average school classroom of 20 kids doesn't have stereo vision. And then there's another large proportion of the population who do have stereo vision, but lose some of their binocular skills if they look, for example, near, like the children with convergence insufficiency. If they look near, they no longer use the two eyes together, so they lose their stereo near, but they have nice stereo vision when looking far. And that's probably another 5 to 10% of the population. So somewhere between 10 to 20% of the population actually has some problem with binocular vision.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Quinn in Dallas. Hi, Quinn.
Oh, hello. And thank you very much for taking my call. And this subject hit a little bit close to home with me because when I was 1 year old, I lost the vision on my right eye. And by the time I was 10, you know, there was this all of these picture books where you stare at it and the image is supposed to pop out. I didn't know that I couldn't do that. I've been staring at that for like hours and, you know, give me a really big headache, but I still couldn't see it. I was just wanting to ask your guest that, you know, what if some person have lose the vision in one eye? Do I have any, you know, disability that I should be aware of? Because I really cannot tell.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
So the question is, are there some problems he should be aware of?
Yeah.
Okay, if Mr. Quinn has lost all vision in one eye, so the eye no longer works at all. If he closes his good eye, he's blind, essentially. Then what he has lost is the ability to see in 3D. But some of the other problems that I mentioned, ironically, he does not have, even though he's lost vision in one eye, which is not anything I would have wished for Mr. Quinn or anybody, but I'm not trying to downgrade the situation. But what he doesn't have, which I experienced and which other people who have what's called lazy eye, for example, experience, is conflict between the two eyes. So the problems I had, for example, reading, didn't come from the fact that I didn't have stereo vision per se. It wasn't that I couldn't see in 3D per se. But the fact that I didn't see in 3D meant that I wasn't using my two eyes in a normal way, and I wasn't aiming the two eyes at the same place at the same time, so that I was receiving conflicting input from the two eyes. My right eye was seeing something different from my left eye, and that's why, for example, when I tried to read, the letters seemed to jump around on the page. So somebody who has lost vision entirely in one eye actually is not dealing with that kind of conflict. And again, then when driving or moving, that conflict isn't present. However, somebody who has lost vision in one eye may actually turn their head and turn their bodies more to look out of the one good eye that they have. And that can lead to postural problems over time because you're constantly... I mean, let's say you've lost your right eye. That means you're going to turn everything to the right so that your left eye is more in the center of your face because that's the eye you can use to see.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jesse in Fort Worth. Hey, Jesse.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, it's all a fascinating story and inspiring as well. I'm curious, how did this all affect your love life? And if you can share, I'll take my response off the air.
Thanks for your call. You are happily married, Sue?
I am happily married. So the question is, how did this affect my love life?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, first of all, I was extraordinarily shy as a child. You know, because I had the crossed eyes and problems in school, and that's not uncommon, you know. I was very, very shy. And when I met my husband, he couldn't believe how shy I was. And in fact, he was always trying to get me to do things to take me out of my shell. And he once even, and I suppose this would appeal to Jesse, he once even challenged me, sort of prodded me into buying a... that magazine, like a Playboy magazine,
mm-hmm.
and to go up and buy it. He said, this will be good for you. You need to get out of your shell. And so it was pretty funny because I went to buy the Playboy magazine. And I'm like, oh, all right, I'll do it. And I walked up to the counter, and the guy said, oh, I don't have any up here. And then he shouts as loud as he could to the back of the store, hey, this lady wants a Playboy. Can you get it for her? Which, of course, made me feel like I wanted to be swallowed by the earth.
In your defense, your husband, you married a guy who seems to fear nothing. Can you tell us what he does for a living?
He's an astronaut. So we lived in Texas for many years, in Houston, not Dallas. But he actually retired from NASA in 2005. But we lived in the Clear Lake area of Houston, and he worked at Johnson Space Center for... from 1992 to 2005, and those were glorious years. He flew on the space shuttle 3 times.
All right, so let's get back to your eyes here. When you were in your late 30s, early 40s, you started having more problems with your vision, which is pretty common for people with strabismus. Is that right?
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And they dealt with this jitteriness, the fact that I was constantly switching views between the two eyes, and particularly when I was looking in the distance, things were jittery.
So you went to at least one doctor who said, what is wrong with you? You're fine. Your vision is perfect. You put glasses on and you're great.
Right. Because all he did was test one eye at a time, and I could read the eye chart, and my vision was 20/20. And this is very important. The retina of my eyes, the health of my eyes was good. Mm-hmm. And of course, I mean, that's very important, extremely important. And that's what he was referring to. But then he said to me, but things are jittery, and I have trouble driving, and he said, well, drive slower, which was comical, considering how slow I drove. And then I said, I have trouble seeing my children when they're on the stage of the school auditorium. Their faces are a blur. And he said to me, if you think you have 20/20 vision in both eyes, if you think you have a problem with your vision, then you have probably been traumatized by your childhood surgeries and you need to see a psychiatrist. Hmm. And I remember I paid the bill and I sort of rushed out of that office and never went back.
So it wasn't a psychiatrist or a psychologist that you needed. It was, in fact, an optometrist. Is that right?
Exactly.
And we'll make the distinction here because optometrists and ophthalmologists, as comes across in the book, don't necessarily share a lot of their research.
That's right, and that's very unfortunate. Ophthalmologists are MDs. They go to medical school, and they treat eye problems and vision problems with surgery and with pharmacology, with drugs. And optometrists go to a 4-year optometry school, and their emphasis is more on the interplay between the eye, the brain, and the eye and the brain and vision. And their specialty is really in prescribing glasses. They were the first to develop contact lenses. They're the ones you go to if you have very low vision and you need some low vision techniques. And they're also concerned about functional day-to-day vision. Now, I didn't just go to an optometrist. I went to a very special type of optometrist, and only a small percentage of even optometrists are part of this group. And this group includes developmental or behavioral optometrists, is usually what they're called. And these are the optometrists who are particularly interested in binocular vision, how we see with two eyes, and interested in optometric vision therapy, which is the therapy I use to learn how to see with two eyes and to gain the stereo vision.
Talk about some of the first exercises that you did, because I know after your first session you thought, this is ridiculous. This is like I'm playing a game with a 4-year-old.
Exactly. So the first exercises that I did in vision therapy were very simple exercises on just looking at things. So what the vision therapist did, and she worked for my developmental optometrist, whose name is Teresa Ruggiero, what she did is she put 4 numbers on the 4 corners of a wall. So a 1, a 2, a 3, and a 4. And then she said to me, had me patch one eye, wear a patch over one eye, and she said, look at the 1, now look at the 3, now look at the 2, now look at the 4. Now look at the 1, hold your gaze on it, point at it, put your arm down, keep your gaze still on that 1, now look over at the 3, or some such. And I thought, this is ridiculous. This is an exercise for a 5-year-old. Well, it happened to be that in my vision therapy session, I always shared it with one other person. The other person was a little person, was a 5-year-old. And so she had the 5-year-old do the task, and the 5-year-old could do it better than I could. Mm-hmm. I really could not sustain my gaze very stably on these letters, on these numbers, as well as a little girl could. So I took the sheets of of numbers home, and I pasted them to my kitchen wall, and I practiced. And those initial exercises were just to teach me how to gaze stably at something, first with one eye, then the other eye, and then both eyes together. And then after I progressed through that, and I got through that relatively quickly, I started doing exercises in which I learned how to point the two eyes at the same place in space at the same time.
Yeah, you use this thing called the Brock string, which is kind of a deceptively simple device. Can you describe it for us?
It is absolutely elegant. It is very simple, and it is as elegant as it is simple. It is a piece of string with a bead or several beads strung along the string. And so the way this exercise works, it's a little hard to explain without, you know, a visual aid, but the way it basically works is take the string, and somebody could try this at home. Take a piece of string, ordinary string, and tie one end to the doorknob, and then walk backwards with the string for, let's say, 2 feet. Then hold the string to the bridge of your nose, right to the middle of your nose, so it's right in between your two eyes, and look down the string to where it attaches to the doorknob. If you have normal binocular vision, your two eyes will aim at the place where the string attaches on the doorknob. And you will see one attachment point. Your brain will fuse the right eye image of the end of the string and the left eye image of the end of the string, where it's attaching to the doorknob. But the other parts of the string that are coming toward you are falling on different parts of the retinas of the two eyes, because that's not what you're looking at right now. You're looking at the end of the string. And so you will see two images. You'll have a double image of the string. And so what you will see is one image of the string attachment point on the doorknob, and then two images of the string coming toward you, like a V.
My guest is Susan R. Berry. She's professor of neurobiology at Mount Holyoke College. We're talking about her new book, Fixing My Gaze, A Scientist's Journey into Seeing in Three Dimensions. We'll get to more of your calls after the break. You can get to us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Susan R. Berry, whose new book is called Fixing My Gaze, A Scientist's Journey into Seeing in Three Dimensions. So you practiced with this string, Susan, until you could sort of see it the way you were supposed to see it. And then I guess you went out to your car after this particular session?
Right. So let me just finish up very quickly about the string. If you do the exercise and you see one image of the string, where it attaches to the doorknob, and then the two string images coming toward you, those two string images are giving you the line of sight of the two eyes. And you see, with information like that, I then knew where each eye was aiming. Initially, I didn't see the string images like I just described, the way you should see them, but I knew what I was supposed to see, and so I learned how to move my eyes into position so that they were both looking at the same thing at the same time. And it was after one session with this Brock string where, using the beads, I would look at a close bead and get the correct string images, and then at a further bead and then back to the close bead, I was learning how to aim my eyes correctly for a close distance and then a distance further away and close again and so on. I went out to my car to drive home, and I looked down at the steering wheel, and it was floating in space. And there was this palpable pocket of space between the steering wheel and the dashboard. Now, I always knew the steering wheel was in front of the dashboard because the steering wheel blocked my view of the dashboard. And I also, you know, I could feel, you know, I could move my arm between the steering wheel and the dashboard. So I knew how the two of them were located in space, but I had never seen this before. I could actually see that there was this volume of space, this pocket of space between the steering wheel and the dashboard. And this was completely extraordinary to me. I was totally surprised by it. And since then, and as I describe in my book, I have found quite a number of other people who have had the same experience where they gain stereo vision and that sense of palpable space as adults. And it was for them the same way, just absolutely a huge surprise and, for the most part, a huge joy in seeing this space. And at first I looked at it, and then I closed one eye, and the steering wheel sort of was back to what I considered normal, sort of just in front of the dashboard. And then I opened the eye, and the steering wheel was sort of floating in front of me. Hmm. And I thought, the sun is setting, and maybe I'm really tired, and maybe the sun's coming in at a funny angle, and this can't possibly be stereo vision, because this was the day after my 48th birthday, and I had been teaching in class for years and years that stereo vision had to develop during a critical period during the early years of childhood, or you could never gain it. So I thought to myself, this can't possibly be stereo vision. It must be some illusion due to the funny sunlight. And so I drove home. And the next day I got up and I did the Braak string procedure and a number of other therapy procedures. And I went out to my car and I went to adjust the rearview mirror, and it was floating in front of the windshield. And all that day, my stereo vision would emerge intermittently. And surprisingly, I'd be looking up at my office ceiling, and I'd see that the light fixture seemed to be floating in air in this volume of, and there was volumes of space between the light fixture and the ceiling, and the light fixture and me. And it was just an absolutely spectacular experience.
You write, you have an absolutely poetic sentence in the book that describes this. You write that you felt suddenly that you were immersed in a medium more substantial than air.
Exactly. The only way I can describe it is I like to snorkel. And when you're underwater and, you know, let's say on a reef or something, and the underwater plants and so on are sort of floating on air, and you have a sense, because you're in the water, you're buoyed up by the water, of this medium between the different plants and the fish and stuff. That's what it felt like. It felt like I was almost snorkeling through the above ground, you know, through the world, that when I looked at leaves on a tree, they seemed to be floating, hovering in air, each leaf in its own space with these pockets of space between the different leaves. It was just spectacular.
Susan R. Berry is my guest. We're talking about her book, Fixing My Gaze. Let's go next to Heidi in Dallas. Hello, Heidi.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I have a quick question. My daughter is 5, and she has been patching her eye to increase her vision. She has, even with correction, her vision is not 20/20. Her depth perception has gotten much better, but her vision itself, even with correction, is still not perfect. The last appointment I had with our eye doctor, he said, I don't think she'll ever have 20/20 vision, even with the patching we've done the last year. I'm asking if she has any advice for me as a parent and maybe at my next steps at this point, since the patching doesn't seem to be working.
Yes, I do have some suggestions. What I would do is, if you have a computer, go to a certain website. It's called the College of Optometrists in Vision Development. And College of Optometrists in Vision Development, the acronym is COVD. And I would go to www.covd.org. And when you get on the homepage, there is a button you can click on called Locate a Doctor. And see if you can find a developmental optometrist near you that would be listed in the Locate a Doctor feature. You put in your zip code, and from there it'll look up what doctors are available. What you want to look for in particular is an optometrist with FCOVD after their name. And FCOVD stands for Fellow of College of Optometrists in Vision Development. A fellow is a person who is an optometrist who has passed a rigorous board certification process in optometric vision therapy and binocular vision. Because like I mentioned before, not all optometrists are schooled in the kind of therapy that I had and the kind of therapy that your daughter could very well benefit from. And so look for somebody with FCOVD after their name, and then I would contact them and see what they have to say. But I think that they may be able to give you the best advice.
By the way, we will put a link to COVD.org on our webpage as well, so people can find it that way.
That's great.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Sarah in Dallas. Hello, Sarah.
Yes. I have a question. I have a four-year-old who had crossing starting at about age two, and we did the patch for a long time. And about a year ago, he had corrective surgery. And he's a very smart, verbal little boy. What I'm having a hard time doing is I don't know if he can see his 1, 2, 3s and his ABCs. I'm having a really hard, and he gets so frustrated at visually learning those. How to keep him from getting so frustrated and teaching him how to read and write without him getting so frustrated after a few minutes that he just wants to quit.
Yeah, Sue, is there anything that you wish you'd known then that you do know now about that sort of thing?
Well, one is the advice I just gave to the other woman, mm-hmm. to look for a good developmental optometrist who specializes in binocular vision, because they do specialize the kind of problems that some children have learning to read, if the reading problem is a result of a vision issue. And it sounds like if this little boy had the crossed eyes, that certainly could be the case. He may need a different set of lenses and that sort of thing. And so a doctor like that would be a good person to consult. I was able eventually to solve my reading problems in two ways. One, my mother was incredible at reading to me and with me constantly. And the other is I actually developed a particular adaptation to reading where I basically read with one eye and really shut down the other. And, that's not the greatest way to see, but it was a way to read. But it's not really the ideal way to overcome this problem. The ideal way is to learn how to use the two eyes together, which is why consulting a developmental optometrist is probably the way to go.
Are the gains that you made through therapy, Sue, are they permanent? Can you assume they are?
They are permanent. Mm-hmm. I was 48 when I started the therapy and started to develop stereo vision. I'm 55 years old now, and like I like to tell people, I'm 55 and I am just getting started. And my vision continues to get better. But I do some procedures every morning. Like some people get up and do some calisthenics or take a run or something like that. What I do is I get up, I go to my basement, I have a Nordic track and a trampoline, and I work out on those. And as I'm working out on the Nordic track and trampoline, I'm also doing some vision therapy procedures at the same time. If I didn't do the procedures, I think my vision would stabilize. I would have binocular vision, but it would not be as good as it could get. I think my vision is continuing to improve, and that's because I continue to do some therapy. But the therapy I do is all on my own. I only went to the vision therapist for a period of a year. The therapy I do now is just the sort of the continually tooling up kind of therapy, the home exercises that I had learned. And then I see my optometrist once every year or once every 6 months, and we check my binocular vision, and if there's any issues, we'll talk about those, and maybe she'll suggest doing a different type of therapy procedure. But basically, my eyes, my vision continues to stay very binocular, my stereo vision continues to improve, and I see the world better today than I ever saw it.
As a mom, I had to chuckle at the passage where you described finding your family's washed and wrinkled laundry to be one of the most beautiful things you'd ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
But I have to wonder, are there things that you wish that you could go back and see again, or that you have made a point of going back to look at again now that you can see in Stereopsis?
You know, yes. There are many places I'd like to go back to again. I was just talking to a friend about a trip he had just taken to Japan. I went to Japan in the year 2000, and that was before my vision changed. Now, Tokyo is this incredibly crowded, busy city, and when I used to go to cities, they just really bothered me. They were way too cluttered. There was way too much going on. I didn't really enjoy them. I think I would enjoy seeing someplace like Tokyo again now much, much more. Another thing is I have a much greater sense of the whole world because my peripheral vision as well as my stereo vision really expanded and improved with the therapy. When I didn't have to work so hard at seeing things, I could actually take in more information. So I take in more through my periphery. So any beautiful kind of mountaintop view would actually, you know, any beautiful scenery that I saw in the past, sure, I'd love to see it again. It would look more more spectacular now than it used to.
Do you know, is there a percentage of people who are in sort of exactly your medical situation for whom this does not work, for whom the therapy doesn't ever come together?
Yes and no. I think anyone who undergoes optometric vision therapy will see some improvement in vision. And people who have strabismus, crossed eyes, have a lot of ways in which they can improve their vision. There are people, however, who will probably never gain stereo vision the way I did. They may get a more stable sense of the world. They may get a much better sense of peripheral vision, but they may never get a good sense of stereo vision. And that depends upon how misaligned their eyes are and how they've adapted to their eye misalignment over all the years. And it also depends really on how hard you're willing to work at the therapy. It's not like you have to change your life for it, but it's kind of like practicing the piano. You have to do a little bit every day. And I would say that probably many of the people who do not do well with therapy are people who just simply don't have the time or motivation to work on it on a daily basis.
So it's not so much difficult as tedious?
I actually enjoy the procedures. I thought they were really fun. And maybe because I'm a neurobiologist and I could think about what was happening to my vision and what I was doing with my vision was part of that. But yes, some of it is because you're, you know, it's like practicing the scales on the piano or, you know, even practicing a jump shot in basketball. You're doing the same thing over and over again. And yes, it can be tedious.
Well, it sounds like it was definitely worth it.
Oh, absolutely.
Susan R. Berry is professor of neurobiology at Mount Holyoke College. Her new book is called Fixing My Gaze, A Scientist's Journey into Seeing in Three Dimensions. Sue, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.